What do archaeologists get wrong?
How are burials treated with respect during an excavation?
And how you can start a new career as an archaeologist.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Thank you for the questions you've sent in. We've had so many of them, and this podcast is dedicated to bringing you a few answers.
Yes, it is. We've also got Helen's Find as well coming up, which I should say, Helen, is fast becoming our most popular feature on all the podcasts that we do. So we're going to do it again. Helen is going to be talking about an object discovered through the process of archaeology and bringing it to life to explain its significance. And what are you going to be talking about this week?
Well, it's something that's very colourful. It's, I think, very beautiful, and it takes a very, very long time to make.
Oh, good tease, good tease. I like that. Let's get into the questions first of all then. And this one, they all, by the way, come from Time Team members. So thank you so much if you are one of them. And if you want to ask a question, that's what you've got to be. Very easy to find out more information on that. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial. This is Leah Kotok, who says, do terms like Bronze Age or Iron Age cover the same time period everywhere, or does it vary country to country? This is such a good question. For instance, says Leah, does the Iron Age continue for the first few centuries CE in countries that weren't occupied by the Romans? Did Africa, Asia, Oceania, or the Americas have the same historical time periods as Europe, or are they divided up differently? I love this question.
Yes, that is an excellent question, and it's one that I only know part of the answer to. So it is true that Bronze Age and Iron Age don't cover the same time period everywhere. So in, for example, Scandinavia, which indeed was not occupied by the Romans, the Iron Age goes all the way up to the medieval period. So there's a fantastic book on Viking religion, which is called Iron Age Myth and Materiality. And I don't think anyone who's interested in the world of the Viking gods would automatically go to a book called Iron Age Myth and Materiality. I think that was the wrong title for such a great and interesting book. But that is what it's called. It's called the Iron Age. It's sometimes called the Post-Roman Iron Age, the PRIA, which helps a little bit. But yeah, everybody in Britain thinks the Iron Age stops with the Romans, and they are utterly confused when they see it on a book that we would call of the early medieval period. It's still the Iron Age in Sweden. So that's partly an answer. But the second part of it, did Africa, Asia, Oceania, and the Americas have the same historical time periods? No, they are divided up differently, but I don't know the equivalents. So I read something about a Clovis point in America, which I assume dates to the Clovis period. I'm not entirely sure. That will probably be named after a particular site. They don't have the same divisions of time as we do. My main flaw as an archaeologist is I'm not at all international, and I would have to send that question off to somebody else.
It makes sense, though, doesn't it, for there to be completely different divisions of time periods in cultures that didn't really interact, whereas your European time periods are likely to have the same divisions because they were developing similar things at similar times. But I find it really interesting that they didn't always exactly line up with one another, depending on who was there, what they were doing, and different sort of competing factors.
Yes, I think you make a very good point with how do we, or how should we, divide up time anyway into periods. It's not obvious when something comes to an end and something else starts. And our three-age system, the Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, is really based on finds. But the people who developed it would say it was based on technology. So at the point where you get most finds made of stone, they would say, the major technology is of stone. I would say that's the technology that they can see, because most of it may have been based on wood or on bone or on other organics that simply don't survive. So stone is the thing that survives from the Stone Age. Bronze is the thing that survives from the Bronze Age. And then we get into a much more complicated set of circumstances because so many more materials from the Iron Age onwards are used. But in places like Australia, the stone technology lasts for much longer. It's used much closer to the present day. So you might say, well, they're a Stone Age culture. Or you might think, actually, that doesn't work. It's the wrong way of looking at things, that we need to divide up periods in different places which concentrate on different activities or have different priorities in a different way. You have to do it ultimately with what you can see archaeologically. So what survives? You can't do it on thought patterns. You can't do it on religions, really, not if all you're dealing with is archaeology. But you could base it more on art, say, rather than technology.
And what age do you think we're in at the moment?
I think I'm afraid that we are going to be in an entirely different age, and it's going to be in the age of plastic. You can see so much plastic.
The plastic age sounds a bit rubbish.
But in our soils, in our archaeological deposits, they're absolutely full of plastic. It's going to be the only thing anybody notices when they come to look at 20th and 21st century deposits. 19th century, it's different. There's a lot of glass, there's a lot of coal. It feels more industrial. We feel plasticky and post-industrial. But how long that carries on for, it's going to be really difficult to tell, because you might have got somebody in, say, I don't know, 18,500 BC that felt that what they were doing was very different to what somebody was doing in 25,000 BC. We can't see the long duration events because we're in the middle of it.
Oh, well, that was very depressing. There we go. I do keep saying that we do need an episode at some point of Helen predicts how the world's going to end, because you and I have had many chats about that, not on this podcast, and I come away from it questioning everything about my life. But anyway, let's put that to the one side and get back onto these questions, because thank you very much for that one. Let's move on to question number two, which comes from Rebecca Clark, who says, this question is a bit of a hypothetical one, as I always wonder when theorizing on life in previous times based on archaeology, what do archaeologists get right and what might get missed? If archaeologists of the future were looking, this is basically what we've been talking about. If archaeologists of the future were looking at our society today purely based on what might survive in the archaeological record, presuming they had similar technology and pretending there's no written records, what do you think they'd conclude about life in the UK in 2026? We've almost sorted this question, Rebecca. It's plastic.
Yes, but I wonder what's going to happen to plastic. Given that plastic is they're organic molecules, aren't they? They're hydrocarbons. There is a decay element built into plastics. Are they going to survive as well as metals and stone? I don't know. And does that depend on what kind of plastic it is and what size it is? So I'm sitting here wearing a fleece that I have to say I bought a long time ago before I realised quite how much they shed in the washing machine. If this fleece makes it into landfill, which of course it won't where I live, it'll go to incineration at the end of its life. I don't know when the end of its life might be, because fleeces just do not seem to wear out. It may not survive to go into the archaeological record at all. Or if it does, it may decay because it's made of these very thin fibres. I don't know. I find this one really, really difficult to get a handle on. On the one hand, we think we've got so much material culture. Surely most of it is going to survive. Surely there's going to be a massive amount for future archaeologists to deal with. And then I think to myself, also though, we have strategies for dealing with that. We have incineration, we have recycling. A bit like with our information age, when we used to carve it into stone tablets, then it was very difficult to get rid of. When it was on paper, it would decay. Now it's in digital form. Will any of it survive at all? Will we actually be leaving behind very little relic of our past? I don't know. It's something that's best accompanied, I think, by a glass of wine and some nibbles, this kind of conversation.
Can I ask you about carbon dating as well? Because that is Rebecca's question presumes that the techniques that archaeologists would be using in the future are the same ones that they're using now. And one of the things that we do use I'm not an archaeologist, but you guys use, is carbon dating. But since the 1950s and all our nuclear bomb and atomic bomb testing, we've basically completely fried the carbon dating because it's just blasted, you know, our world, our atmosphere is just blasted with radiation from those nuclear bomb tests that basically anything post 1950-ish you can't do carbon dating on because you don't get a result. So that's going to make it quite difficult for archaeologists of the future to use that technique to carbon date anything.
Well, I'm not sure about that, you know. I think if we go 500, 1,000, 1,500 years into the future, I think carbon dating might come back because, as I understand it, the nuclear tests disrupted the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere, but they haven't stopped its decay rate. The half-life is still the same. And all through history, all through the past, the proportions of carbon-14, carbon-13 and carbon-12 have changed slightly, and that's what our calibration curve is. So, you know, when we have a carbon date that comes back and we say, oh, well, this calibration curve's very flat around this time, so we can't get a precise date. That's because the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere can belong to many different periods, if you see what I mean. So we don't know which one. But the ticking of the clock stays the same. The atomic clock stays the same. So maybe the disruption of the 20th century will simply be a massive spike on the calibration curve. And maybe paradoxically, it'll make things slightly easier because everything was changing so fast that we can get a more precise date. I think, don't be so gloomy, Martin. In 1,000 years' time, it might be fine again.
Yeah, or we might have had another few nuclear bombs go off, yes. And then it'll be even harder. But anyway, I think that'd be a problem for somebody else to deal with. There we go. Great question, Rebecca. Thank you very much. We shall get back to the questions in just a moment after Helen's find, which we can do now. Now, this is the bit of the podcast where Helen talks about a find, an object, an item discovered through the process of archaeology, and there's usually a story behind it, but sometimes it can just look really interesting. As always, I put the link to this object, which is from the Portable Antiquities Scheme, in the description of this podcast. So if you want to actually look at the item we're talking about, go to the description. You can click on a link there and have a look. I am doing that right now, and I'm looking at, what am I looking at here? It looks very pretty. There's lots of colours on it. This is a buckle of some description.
It's a buckle plate. Yes, that's right. And I've chosen it for several reasons, partly because it is so pretty and partly because it's got this rather remarkable design that I want to talk about. But lastly, it was found by the village team at Norton Disney, the research project there that's been going on for years. It was just after we'd done the time team work there in the autumn of 2024. In the November, they found this buckle plate. So we couldn't include it in our programme, but it really is worth looking at in a bit of detail. To describe it, it's kind of roughly rectangular. It's got the remains of a hinge on one side, and that would have hinged on the buckle itself, so allowed the buckle to swivel. And the pin of the buckle would also have swiveled there in the middle of the hinge. The other end would have been riveted onto the leather belt, and you could see the little holes for the rivets. So it would have been worn at the waist. But then the really obvious thing that you can see there is those bright colours of the enamel. And there are a lot of colours. So there's the green,
blues and reds and yellows in there.
I think there's about five colours there. There's turquoise and a red as well. And they're all inlaid into this copper alloy base. And the tops of the metal surrounds around the enamel would have been gilded. So it would have been bright and it would have been shiny. And it reminds us that the medieval world was a really colourful world. Mostly we tend to think of it as being a bit muted, that the bright chemical colours of today weren't available. But looking at these enamel colours, they are definitely acid bright chemical colours, aren't they? And of course they are chemicals, they're the colourants in the glass. But we just tend to forget about medieval colours, I think, some of the time, and this reminds us. But if you zoom in really close to it, you'll see that the thing that makes it special in terms of the enamelling, the colours, the individual colours fade into each other at the edges, which is exceptional. Most of the time, enamelling is separated, the different colours are separated by the edges of the metal cells. And it is technically really hard to achieve a colour change like that in enamelling, and it was only done, it seems, in one place in the medieval world, and that was in the workshops of Limoges in France. So this object has been imported from France. And the way it's been done, amazingly, we have a book that was written by a monk called Roger of Helmershausen in the 12th century. He calls himself Theophilus, and so we tend to know it as Theophilus's handbook. It describes how you do lots and lots and lots of craftsmanship, and enamelling is one of the things he describes. And he says that how you do it is like this. You take a bit of glass of the right colour, you powder it, and he gives very specific instructions as to how you turn it into a powder, and then you add a little bit of water so it's like wet sand. You can manipulate it, and you load it into a quill, like a quill pen. He says, sharpened like a pen, and you put it into the cell very carefully with a little pin tool to get it out of the quill. And you repeat that with all the colours. So they're built up as a kind of damp sand. Then you have to dry it for ages very carefully so that all the water goes without the colours merging too much into each other. So you've dried it, and then you have to heat it to fuse the enamel, to melt the glass and fuse the enamel to the back plate. Now, apparently, that makes it shrink. So you have to do it all over again to top it up, two or three times. You do it again and again and again until you've filled the cells, and then you have to polish it down, and then you have to add the gilding. And he gives all these instructions about how to polish. You start off with various abrasives. You can use a whetstone, and in the end you're polishing it with powdered potsherd, he says, the kind of ancient pots that you can find. You polish it with bits of potsherd that are lubricated with spit and all rubbed in with a goat skin. So it's very precise. You can follow his instructions, but it obviously takes a very long time, and you have to be very, very, very expert in what you do. So these would have been incredibly expensive and rare. And the person who lost this in Norton Disney in the 12th or 13th century would have been presumably very, very upset.
Absolutely
particularly
livid.
As it's in, yeah. And it's in really good condition. There is a tiny bit of the enamel missing. Can you see on the top right, there's half a cell that's lost its enamel. And you can see underneath that the surface is roughened, it's kind of grooved, and that would have made a keying to hold the enamel in. So you can see, because of this break, you can see more about how it was made, which is really nice. But then, Martin, if you look at it, kind of zoom out again and look at it in its entirety, can you see what the design is trying to show?
I wondered, it's almost like feathers, maybe, like individual feathers coming off. Well, I'm not sure. It's or like wings, maybe, or something.
Yeah, I think it's wings. I think that if you look at the red bit, the kind of U-shape of red, I think that's the body of an animal, and the blue end is the head, and then these sweeping out V-shapes of blue are wings, and I think what we're looking at is actually an insect, and I think it's a butterfly.
Oh, you think butterfly? I thought you were going to say dragonfly, but I can see butterfly as well. Yeah,
it's some kind of insect, yes. And this one is, in fact, one of three that we know of. There's another one that was found in Surrey and another one that was fairly recently found in Norfolk. So when you look at all three of them together, they do look very much like medieval butterflies. And I think that's the link to Cernabis that I was teasing you about, that Cernabis, the area that's been acquired by the National Trust, is home to 36 different species of butterfly. And that reminds us of how many there are and how much people love them, how much people notice them. And yet What a funny name they've got, butterfly. Individual butterfly species, it's often pointed out that these don't have old names. They're mainly coined in the 19th century by butterfly enthusiasts. And it seems like things like tortoiseshell or red admiral or cabbage white, did they have names before? And if not, why not? It seems really weird not to give names to these beautiful things. And so it's been thought that the Anglo-Saxons didn't really think much about butterflies, and neither did people in the medieval world, because neither of them gave a name beyond butterfly. And nobody actually knows what butterfly means. It might mean a butter-coloured fly, which might be the brimston. But what about all the other species? So I think butterflies are more interesting than other people have thought. And there have been a few people who've done work on butterfly illustrations in manuscripts, and there's more than you might think. But this is an object that isn't just pretty in its own right. I think it's telling us something about the medieval attitude to insects. And butterflies can be seen on other objects if you look closely. You can begin to find them. You can argue that because they're combinations of ovals often, are these geometrical designs or are they real butterflies? But I'd be interested in knowing what people think. Is this a real butterfly? How does it fit in with manuscript illustrations? It's a very interesting object, I think, with more to tell us.
Yeah, definitely. People love butterflies. They hate moths, don't they? poor old moths. They always get a bad press.
You're listening to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek, and this episode is dedicated to answering your questions.
I've got two questions here that I'm sort of lumping together as one because I think there's some overlapping themes which might make sense. So let me attack the first question first, and then we can see how the next question kind of goes into it. Lee says, I have no doubt that archaeology is vital to our understanding of the past, present, and future. When done with great care, understanding, and respect. There are some, my elderly mother being just one, who believe that this is not a good collection of reasons for unearthing the past, that especially when it comes to people, perhaps even our own direct ancestors, that archaeologists are wrong. They should show complete, total respect and leave well alone. What are your views on this sensitive topic? Well, this is a subject area we have touched on before, the kind of ethics of doing archaeology.
Yes, and I think that it depends very much on what you mean by respect, because some people in the past have left us enough detail in their writings to know that what they wanted was to be remembered. They wanted their deeds to live on after they died. And the best way that I know of to do that is to find out everything that we can about their deeds. And for many aspects of ancient societies, for prehistoric societies and sometimes for historic societies, societies that have written records, the best way we can find out about what really happened is through archaeology. So I feel that archaeology is a respectful thing by its very nature. That archaeology, because it seeks to understand, it seeks to inquire, it asks about people, it is respectful, and that not asking is less respectful. But it's interesting what Lee's mother thinks, because my mother has also got a slightly different view. I hope she's not listening, because I have to say that she actually thinks it's a waste of time thinking about the past, because she's very, very forward-looking. She thinks, why do we put all of that effort into understanding the past when we could be making the present and the future a better place? Why not knock down that silly old listed building, she would say. You could make a nice new, comfortable, well-insulated house with lots of bathrooms. Or you could even put a much-needed fast railway line through it. Why bother preserving the past? It's not what we want these days. That's my mother's view. Now, when we come down to it, I just think that if you ignore our past, if you sideline it, that's the disrespectful thing. Because if we don't know anything about our past, if we haven't got a body of knowledge already, what are we going to do when we build my mother's fast railway line and discover that we've gone slap bang through a medieval churchyard, which we don't understand and which we don't know how to salvage? That would be the ultimate disrespectful thing. But it's such a debate. Everybody's got their own views. And it's really astonishing to find out that other people hold a different view to you. And that's what I find most interesting, all the different views.
This question then sort of follows on from that, and you see what I mean when I read it, because it's to do with the ethics of archaeology. Simon Barnes says, when you're digging and find a body, do you ever feel slightly uneasy about moving it? I always feel as though it may be slightly uncomfortable to treat burials as archaeological finds, especially when they're fairly recent. What are the archaeological rules for this? And I know that, for instance, in Scotland, you need to call the police if you find a body. Again, this is another question we get quite a lot, isn't it? What do you do when you find a body? But it's touching on the ethics that we were discussing as well.
Yes. Now, you do always need to involve the police or the Ministry of Justice if you find human remains, because you need a license to excavate them in just the same way as you'd need a license to exhume a body. You're supposed to get it in advance if you think there's any likelihood of excavating and finding human remains. But obviously, they do sometimes turn up unexpectedly, and then you just need to get in touch and retrospectively get your license. So that's the kind of legal aspect. But the ethics about feeling slightly uneasy about it. Well, one of the problems, of course, is that archaeologists look to their own views. And if you have become an archaeologist, you generally feel that if you died, you'd want someone to dig you up and find out all about you, and that you'd get a kind of odd second life by being the person excavated. You might not be there to see it, but you have a nice warm feeling that you would be contributing to scholarship. So we may not be the most unbiased observer as archaeologists, but I feel that we're there to recover the person, we're there to find out more about them, we're there to make their acquaintance, if you like, to find out who they are, who they were. And again, the most disrespectful thing that I think we could do, and the thing that would make me feel uncomfortable, is to just quietly rebury them in a mass grave, which does occasionally happen. They're quietly reburied and we forget about them. I feel we owe it to the people we have discovered to find out all about them, whether we can do that now with the techniques that we have now, or whether we would keep the remains handy so that we can study more in the future when our abilities have improved. So as ancient DNA techniques get better and better, we would want to have those remains to go back to compare what we knew before with what we know now. It's a way of being useful even after you have died. Almost like, it's not as crucial or important, but if you're donating your organs after you've died, you can do a good thing after you've died. You can also contribute to human knowledge after you've died, and that's a wonderful thing.
And treating that body that's discovered and excavated with respect, I know, is something that a lot of archaeologists will take very seriously. And a good example of that would be in the Princely Burial number 2 episode from last month. You'll remember there's a really poignant scene, Helen, that you're involved in, where you say a few words and I think you put some flowers over the body, and that just sort of shows that the people involved in that excavation care and understand that that was once a person with a life who has died tragically before their time, because it was a young boy who died.
Yes, and a teenage girl. I think what sometimes we can lose sight of is that these graves are not data packages, or they're not just data packages. Each one is a human tragedy. And what we might be guilty of forgetting is the family involved. We want to remember that it's not just one person in a grave. It's a person who was loved and a person who was lost, and that we ought to say thank you a bit to them. We can't get their consent after all these years, but we can say thank you for participating in our research, and that we value them as people as well as objects of intellectual inquiry. So, yeah, I think it is a nice thing to be able to say goodbye. There's always a horrible moment of filling in a grave that's been excavated. That's always a piece of the excavation that, to me, is a bit of, I have my own little bit of sadness. It's like a second funeral. And I think it helps us as well to just take note and say goodbye.
Let's get the final question here. And in fact, this is a similar question that's coming from two different people. So again, I'm gonna clump them together. I hope you don't mind. Matt and Andrew, who have contributed these questions. So Matt says, this is Matt Pascoe, who says, as a 41-year-old, I'd like to think there's still plenty of life left in me. There definitely is, Matt. I've often dreamed of a career change, but never got any qualifications beyond A-levels. Any advice on getting into a career in archaeology or archaeology-related in any way? That's from Matt. Andrew, very similar question here. Andrew Stockwell says, I'm 53, just retired from the police. I've been a history geek all my life, a metal detectorist for 5 years. How can I get involved in digs, even as a volunteer digger for free? Is there a way someone in my position could get into archaeology? So two people here both want to get into archaeology in some way.
Yes, well, there will be advice out there from the Council for British Archaeology and from the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists. There are things like apprenticeships available now. Those are not restricted to school leavers like they might have been in the past. You can do them at any age, and you don't need qualifications necessarily to get into them. I think my kind of big advice is to creep up on your career in archaeology. So do it slowly. Do some volunteering with your local field group. You can Google for those. Then maybe take some holiday from work. Matt or Andrew, you've got time. Volunteer maybe with a commercial unit. The bigger ones, the Oxford unit, the Cotswold, etc., they will all have volunteering opportunities as part of their public engagement. And in that way, you can not only see if you like it, but you'll also have a head start on others when you're competing to apply for jobs and apprenticeships and so on. Another really good thing to look at is what we call Badger, which is the British Archaeology Jobs and Resources, so BAJR, their website. That's where pretty much all the opportunities are. But also, don't forget, if you're changing career, don't feel like, oh, I didn't do it in the first place, therefore I'm worse. What you've got is you've got extra experience, extra life knowledge, and you'll bring expertise from that. So if you are in medicine, say you're a nurse, a paramedic, a doctor, a physiotherapist, whatever, they make the best osteoarchaeologists. Teachers often find themselves turning into archaeology communicators. Andrew, being a police officer, well, you're just going to have so many transferable skills, things like data handling, people handling, reading situations, heritage crime. You know, you've got all sorts of strings to your bow that you could bring. Matt, I don't know what you do, but no doubt you've got experience that will be relevant, because archaeology is about all aspects of life. Whatever you bring to it will be different to whatever somebody else brings to it, and everything is relevant. There's nothing totally irrelevant. So get in touch with your local volunteer groups, get in touch with your local professionals. You just need to make contact, you need to make your networks, keep asking around, and eventually you'll find the way through. Now, it may mean that you end up going to university. It may not. You may not need to. The person who I always like to mention here is Eric Higgs, who, this is many, many years ago, back in the middle of last century, but he worked in a bank all his life. He retired at 65 and he went to university to study archaeology. And during his retirement, he became one of Britain's best and most revolutionary prehistorians. He did an enormous amount of work and he started all of it after he'd retired. So it is never, never, never too late.
Andrew and Matt, very, very best of luck to you. And keep in touch, please, because I'd love to know how you're getting on and how you're discovering your newfound enjoyment of archaeology, whether it's through a career change or just something that you do as a hobby. It'd be really interesting to hear more about it. Anyway, that is pretty much it from your questions for this episode. Thank you very much for sending them in.
Yes, and next week, Time Team's Giselle Kirai is out on Ilkley Moor looking for prehistoric rock art.
We will see you then. We'll see you on YouTube. And as always, we're here wherever you get your podcasts.
Speak to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.